And we blame folks of color for engaging in what we derisively term identity politics, ignoring that there would be no identity politics in which to engage had whites, or rather Europeans, not created and fabricated our own white identity out of disparate European backgrounds for the sake of aggrandizing power, privilege, and opportunity. That is to say, if Europeans don't create identity politics along the lines of race, then we don't have to worry about black and brown folk doing it on their own. Identity politics is created by the dominant group, and then we turn around and blame the non-dominant for responding based on their interest as non-dominant and oppressed and exploited group members, which seems a bit backward. So then what does it mean to be white? If we want to focus some attention on that, and I insist that we do, what does it mean? Well, on the one hand, it's what I've already said. It is the ability to focus on everyone but you. That's part of what it means to be white. It's the ability to set up the frame within which all conversation about race will transpire. It is the ability to not only have your perspective heard, which goes without saying, but to make sure that your perspective will become the perspective, the ability, as Malefiasante says, to universalize the particular, to take that which is specific to you and make it stand in for the normal, natural, everyday, everybody human experience. It is something which, if we have to create a word for it, we could call perspectivism. The ability to make your perspective, combine it with power, and make it stick for everyone. Can't remember who said it first. It was either Wade Nobles or the folks at the People's Institute. But either way, it's quite a brilliant comment posed in the form of a question. The question, it's almost like a riddle, is when we all sit down together and gather around the multicultural table, what do white people bring? And the answer, of course, is the table. So that's what it means. And I could spend a lot of my time and a lot of yours addressing specifically the various privileges, the very advantages, the various immunities, if you will, that extend to people on the basis of whiteness. But my book addresses that. All of my other writings address that. And so I'm not going to belabor that point here. Instead, I want to go in a slightly different direction rather than simply ticking off a litany of privileges that I think and I hope are understood, though I'm willing to discuss them in the Q&A. Instead, I want to talk about what whiteness means through the lens of a particular phrase, a particular statement about whiteness made by James Baldwin in Ebony Magazine in 1965. And it is, to me, perhaps the most brilliant single comment about whiteness made by anyone, including Baldwin, who made several such brilliant comments during the course of his life and his career as a writer. And here is what he said. He said, these innocent people, and he was using the term innocent in the only most ironic sense of the term, you know, with sort of tongue planted firmly in cheek. He said, these innocent people are trapped in a history they do not understand, and until they understand it, they cannot be released from it. Now, that comment to me is both brilliant at first blush and also sort of inherently counterintuitive. How can one be both brilliant and counterintuitive? Very easy. Of course, Baldwin wasn't really being counterintuitive. He's trying to make a deeper point. But I know that when people hear the comment, once I told somebody that quote and they said, well, that's counterintuitive. Because after all, how can you be trapped when you're the top dog? How can you be trapped in anything when you've got the advantage and you've got the power and you've got the privilege? Isn't Baldwin sort of over-assuming the degree to which white folks are actually trapped? And then the person said, well, in addition, it's counterintuitive because for Baldwin to say until they understand it, they can't be released from it, assumes they want to be released from it. And why in the world would they want that? But Baldwin, of course, is not one to spout nonsense in the course of his writing. He knew about what he was speaking. He was trying to imply, as very few people did during the time that Baldwin wrote about these subjects. He was one of few to engage this issue and to insist that indeed there was something happening to white people. There was something that had happened to us and that was continuing to happen to us that was damaging, that was destructive. It was obviously destructive to him as a black man. It was destructive to all persons of color, but he insisted that it was also destructive to whites. In today's terminology, we might call that collateral damage. in the sense that whites are certainly not the intended victims of a system of racism and subordination and racial domination that we have in this country. But just because we are not the intended victims does not mean that we cannot be damaged by it anyway. And so the question I want to engage, and I engage it some in the book, I want to engage it more tonight, is why would privileged people, dominant group members, want to be released from this trap? And what is this trap anyway? After all, these are important questions to ask and to answer, because our culture obviously does not encourage privileged people to give away their edge, right? So it does seem counterintuitive. Why would you do that? Why would you want to give up something that places you above others in a hyper-competitive society where being above others is part of the point of the society, right? After all, our parents, when we're young, they tell us things like, count your blessings. They don't then proceed to follow that up with, and then give them all away. You know, they just want you to count them so you know how many you have. And back in the day, several of you will remember this. It was not something as common in my generation, which is to say people born, let's say, from about the mid-60s on. But from what I understand from parents, it used to be very common for parents to tell their kids, eat all your vegetables, you know, their children starving in China or wherever there was something going on, Biafra, whatever, something bad. Eat all your vegetables. There are also children starving in the U.S., so, you know, eat your vegetables, which is really sort of an invitation to gluttony, right? Because obviously, you know, they're not saying there are people starving in China, box up your food and send it there. They're basically saying, there are people starving. Yeah, they're dying. They have no food. Here, would you like seconds? Would you like thirds? You see, so we're not giving away our edge. We're encouraged to keep it and to bank it and to take more advantage of it. So then in a culture like that, you know, how do you get people to want to change? Well, I think the only way is, of course, to demonstrate this thing Baldwin was trying to get at, which is the way in which the dominant group is damaged, even as we receive huge relative benefits. And I want to suggest that there are three ways, three levels at which whites are damaged. We are, again, collateral damage, and I do not want to equate this to the damage done to people of color by a system of white supremacy. They are not the same. They are not equivalent. But these are the damages that we as whites had best take quite seriously if we want to understand not only what it means to be white on the upside, but what we pay for the receipt of those privileges. Because I want to suggest that the cost is rather enormous, and that indeed there are some real reasons beyond the moral, beyond the ethical, beyond the merely altruistic, which again are not things that are encouraged in this culture. Altruism for the sake of altruism, doing the right thing because it's the right thing, is not something which has a lot of cultural resonance in this society. But I want to suggest that there is some real self-preservation and some self-interest in creating a more equitable and just society. The three levels at which whites are damaged, the costs are paid in the following terms: mental and emotional terms, political and economic terms, and then also in terms of the loss of personal integrity. These things may sound ephemeral and somewhat abstract to you. I will try to make them more solid. On a mental and emotional level, it is simply a truism, that is to say, something so true it cannot be argued intelligibly, right? That to be white in this time, if not other times, but certainly in this time, is to almost by definition not understand the world around you. It is to live in a fantasy world of your own creation that bears almost no resemblance to the truth. This is true not only with regard to our inability seemingly to perceive racism as an ongoing reality, but a lot of other things as well. First, let's talk about the issue of race itself. What other than a removal from the real world could possibly lead white America to believe as it does? And this does not mean, when I say white America, see, there's this thing. White folks are not, we're not used to this. This is called race talk. Black and brown folk do race talk and they understand the language. When you say white America, you don't mean every single solitary white person in the joint. You mean white people as a corporate entity, this larger structure. So I did not calling individuals out, not saying bad things about individual human beings, flesh and blood people, talking about this larger structure, that white America as a larger corporate entity, if you will, is very quick to deny the existence of racism in spite of the evidence. What else other than a removal from the real world could explain that? What am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about the poll taken not all that long ago in the late 90s where white folks were asked, do you believe that racial discrimination against peoples of color is still a significant national problem? And a whopping 6%, that is to say 6 out of 100, said yes, that it was still a significant national problem. To give you an idea of how pathetic and anemic this response is, I would have you compare it and contrast it to another number gathered in a previous survey of about 2 years prior, in which roughly 12% of white Americans had no compunction at all telling pollsters that we believe there was a fairly decent chance that Elvis Presley might still be alive. For those of you who were not good at calculating probability and statistics, or in this case, just sort of doing simple math, I will tell you what that means. It means, in fairly simple terms, that whites are, what, two times as likely to believe that Elvis might still be alive as we are to believe what people of color tell us they experience on a regular basis. Not that they read about it in a book, or that they saw something about it on a PBS special or heard about it on the radio, that they lived it, and yet only 6% of white folks are willing to believe that which we are being told fairly regularly is happening. This kind of denial on the part of otherwise sane and decent and I would think fairly intelligent and humane human beings is stunning, and it's intergenerational. It's not new. So, for example, in a Gallup poll taken in 2000 and then again in 2004, they do it every 4 years, in fact, white Americans were asked the question in a slightly different way. The question was, do you believe that people of color are treated equally in your community in regard to housing, education, and within the criminal justice system and policing? So it wasn't quite the same as the other one about, do you think it's a big problem? But it was still, it was trying to gauge white America's perception. And they also asked the question of black and brown folk, right? So white folks get asked this question, and between 70 and 80% of white Americans, depending on which category, housing, education, or criminal justice was being asked about, 70 to 80% of white folks said, oh, yes, absolutely. People of color are treated fully equally in our community. Of course, you ask black and brown folk the very same question in those very same communities, they had a slightly different take, right? But you should know that that denial is not just the luxury of 40 years after the Civil Rights Act. It's not simply that white Americans have fallen into this kind of la-la land because, after all, we passed all these laws, and so you can sort of excuse that ignorance because naturally things have gotten so much better. Oh, no, no. This is very much the exact same answer that was given by white Americans in 1962 when the same question was put to them by the Gallup organization. Because see, these pollsters, they got this funny little habit. They ask the same question year after year because that's how they get what social scientists call longitudinal validity, right? They can't make decisions about how views have changed if they ask the question differently. So they ask the same question in 1962. And what do you know, between 70 and 80% of white Americans then, prior to the Civil Rights Act, prior to the Voting Rights Act, 6 years before the Fair Housing Act, only 8 years after Brown v. Board, but long before any schools had moved with all deliberate speed, which was neither deliberate nor speedy, to do anything about school inequity, white folks were convinced that everything was fine. And this, of course, is a remove from reality that is the result of privilege. If one has the privilege of never having to know the truth, because one doesn't have to live around those who know it and live it, if one has the ability to move where one wants, when one wants, one doesn't have to educate one's children around those who know it and live it. One has the ability and the freedom and the mobility and the privilege of going where one wants, when one wants. When those things are true, then it becomes very easy to live in that ignorance. What I want to suggest is that that ignorance is not healthy, that there is a cost to it, not only borne by those who were the victims of it, those who were of color, but even for those who are white. And then white folks get shocked when the truth hits us in the face. White people get shocked about a lot of things. We get shocked and then we get indignant. And there is nothing more dangerous than indignance on the part of people with too much power. Right? Especially when we get shocked. We can't believe it. Everything, we're like, I don't know if you ever did this, but back when I was really broke, and I'm lucky I'm not really broke anymore, but when I was really broke, I had this habit. And sometimes I still catch myself doing it. When I go to the ATM machine to get money, I wouldn't look at the receipt, right? I didn't want to look at the receipt because I didn't want to know how little money I had. And I thought that, like, if I didn't look, that it wouldn't matter. Like, the money would be more if I just didn't know the truth. And white America is sort of like me with my ATM receipt that I'm not looking at. I don't want to look. But then, you know, what I do from time to time is you put the receipt on the table and you're cleaning up and you pick it up one day and you go, oh, my God. I didn't realize I had so little money. That's like white America. We all of a sudden look at the receipt, you know, we look at the slip and we go, oh my God. And then we get really angry for like a minute. So Katrina happens, and white folks are shocked. We discover poor black people in New Orleans, where we had no idea there were any. We had no idea there were people suffering, that there were people in poverty, that there were people who didn't have cars or credit cards or checks or extra cash laying around with which they could have left town. And we were stunned. And not just, you know, sort of white America corporately, but very specific representatives. People like David Brooks, columnist for the New York Times, very conservative, right? And boy, he was stunned. He was shocked. He couldn't believe it. He wrote columns for like 4 days. Oh my God, this is terrible. He was just blown away, and he wrote this piece. He said, "This has shattered our faith in the institutions of our system." Who in the hell is we? Who is our here? Whose faith? You see, the only way you had any faith to shatter is if you were a member of the privileged group. You think black folk in New Orleans were stunned that nobody came for them? Is that shocking? Nobody had come for them 6 months earlier when they were just dealing with police killings and just dealing with poverty and just dealing with crumbling schools. And nobody came 40 years earlier when they took the interstate and drove it through the heart of the black community, as happened in every major city in this country, and uprooted black homes and destroyed black businesses to help white folks get from their suburban homes, where only they could live, to the cities where they still worked. See, sometimes displacement isn't because of a storm. It's very much not a natural disaster. And some folks know that reality and they live it. And some folks are stunned by it, so that when it happens, we just can't believe the system would let people down. This was a system failure. No, it's not. That's only a failure if you think the system was set up to serve poor black folk. And if you think that, you're living on another planet. If, on the other hand, you know that it wasn't set up to serve such people, but if anything, to either destroy them or to neglect their needs altogether, this was a system working exactly as planned. And that's not conspiratorial. That's just functional sociological theory. It was functional to not worry about them at the federal, state, or local level, sink or swim, because that's what our culture is really all about. Economically, politically, and socially. So we really ought not be shocked, but we are. And I got to tell you, that's not healthy. See, here's why. There's a real point to this, and I'll get to it. But there was a survey taken a few years back where they asked white America to speculate on the various percentages of different groups of people, right? Just to sort of see, like, how in tune are white people with the actual demographics of their country, right? Seemingly easy question. So they asked, and the median answer, that is to say the typical, the midpoint answer, right, the median typical answer given by white Americans was this, that African Americans nationwide now were 32% of the population. The actual number is about 13. That Latinos were 21% of the population. The actual number is 13. That Asian Pacific Americans were 10% of the population. The actual number is about 4. And that as a subset of whites, Jews were 18% of the population, whereas the actual number is about 2.5 to 3%. Now, I just want you to add these things up for a second so you can see what kind of delusion we're talking about. If you think that black, Latino, and Asian folks are 32, 21, and 10, that is 63%. You are saying the typical white American now is saying that roughly 2/3 of their country are people of color. And then those Jews take another 18%. Now we're up to 81%. So only 19% of America are white non-Jewish people. No wonder white America is paranoid. They think that, oh my God, they're already taking over. And yet they keep asking for affirmative action. And they keep demanding, quote unquote, minority scholarships. And now they want reparations. And they're already the majority. Leave us alone. Right? Where do you think this anxiety comes from? Comes from a fundamental ignorance and misperception, and that comes from privilege, because only privileged people have the luxury of not knowing anything about the country they live in. People of color have to learn everything in the world about white folk. If you want to graduate from white-dominated schools, if you want jobs in a white-dominated society, you got to learn how white folks think and what white folks experience and what they want you to experience and what they expect from you. White folk can just live over here. Two-thirds of the country are people of color, and nothing happens to us for our ignorance, except that we become highly anxious. We feel like we're outnumbered, and it encourages this paranoia, this idea that they are taking over, that they are coming for what we have. And this paranoia and anxiety are not healthy. They lead to all kinds of dysfunctional and pathological responses and reactions, both at the racial level at the religious level, at the national level, and all of these things interrelate. This notion that we've got to get them before they get us. Where does this come from? Except privilege, because after all, it's only the privileged who have to sit there and sweat that somebody's coming for their stuff, right? This is why I never quite understood why we were so insistent on saying about America now, about the U.S., we're number one. Shush, don't say that. Nobody's coming for Sweden. Nobody's coming for Denmark. Nobody's coming for number two, three, or four. When you say you're number one, see, then you set yourself up for this mindset of they're coming for us. The immigrants are coming for what we have. George Kennan, one of the fathers of the Cold War, wrote this memo back in 1950 in Foreign Policy or Foreign Affairs magazine, right? This article, right? Where he talked about the rest of the world, and he was really speaking of these nations of color in combination with the Soviet Union wanting to take what we have. Privileged people are always worried about who's beneath them. So that's why we get concepts like preventative war. What is that except the rationale and the logic of a privileged group of people going to war with somebody so they won't go to war with you, making war to prevent war? It's not only Orwellian. It comes inherently from a position of privilege. We got to get them. Three strikes laws. We got to get them. We got to lock them up before they come for us. War on drugs. We got to get them before they come for us, you see. This is part of the dysfunctionality of that privileged mindset. It leads to this constant anxiety, this constant stress. So do I really have to explain to you the meaning behind the headline in the newspaper's AP story in June of 2004, referencing a study that had just been or was about to be published in the Journal of the American Medical Association? And that article had the following title: United States Posts Highest Rate of Mental Illness. No kidding. I wonder what that might be about. Now, I read the study, not only the article about the study, but the study in JAMA, and it was interesting. This was a national level study done with nations all around the world. And what they found, and they were not looking at organic disorders, by the way. This wasn't things like schizophrenia, bipolar, etc., because there's not really any reason with things that are really rooted in brain chemistry and organic to think that there would be a substantial difference around the globe. So they weren't looking at those. They were looking at anxiety disorders, depression, and substance abuse disorders. Now, this is interesting. They found that 26% of all persons in the United States, and if you know the way these samples are done, they almost always oversample whites, okay, almost always oversample the dominant group, that 26% of people in the U.S. were suffering from some type of a medically recognized DSM-4, as flawed as the criteria may be, nonetheless, using existing criteria, suffering from some form of an anxiety, depression, or substance abuse mental disorder. That was double the global average. It was five times the percentage in Nigeria, where only 5% of Nigerians suffered from any of these disorders. By the way, this study was not done by the pharmaceuticals in the hope of selling more drugs, so it can't, you know, that would obviously make it very flawed. But it was done by scientists with no particular connection to the pharmaceuticals. They were using the same criteria and finding this huge disproportion of people with mental illness in the United States. Now, why is that? Because think about it. I would imagine that folks in Nigeria who have lived through all kinds of both economic, political, and social dislocations and stresses are certainly dealing with more absolute stress, I would imagine, than those of us in the wealthiest, most powerful nation on earth. And yet, they seem to affect far less mental disorder and disease than those of us in this powerful and amazingly privileged space. What might explain that? Well, it can't be proven, but I would certainly argue that at least in part, being privileged, being dominant, being the hegemon within the global order is exactly what encourages that level of anxiety-related disorders. Never feeling like you have enough. Never feeling like what you have is safe. People who are not in the dominant position have other concerns related to survival, not necessarily hoarding what they have because they don't have. But those who have, and particularly those who have a lot, and particularly when they know, be it conscious or subconscious, that those things they have didn't all come about because of superior morals, superior ethics, or superior genetics, that indeed they came about because of some forms or many forms of injustice, it encourages that kind of paranoia. You see, when you're the king of the hill, whether it's racial, national, religious, or anything else, any rise at all from those below you, any improvement in the situation of those below, any challenge to your hegemony and your dominance, even if your dominance is still largely intact, is seen as a huge threat, and it is magnified many fold. So in other words, to be members of the dominant group, whether we're talking in racial terms, whether we're talking in national terms, or especially a combination of those two things, can be highly stressful and anxiety-producing in a way that's unhealthy. That is to say that equity might actually be a much healthier place from which to organize a society. To not have that is to constantly be on edge in a way that isn't healthy, and then when something happens, you're not prepared. So 9/11 happens. And I know that anyone, white, black, or otherwise in this country, on September 11th was afraid, they were shocked, they were stunned. Well, not really shocked or stunned, but afraid and upset and even perhaps angry. But it was interesting, was it not, that in the week or so after 9/11, when I was watching media pretty much around the clock, looking and seeing what people were saying, that the only people who said, "Why do they hate us?" were white. I didn't see any people of color asking that question. Not to say that none thought it or wondered it, but the only people who seemed to be walking around in a total daze, totally unhinged, "Why do they hate us? I don't understand," were white. Now, not every white person said it, but only, in my experience, did white people say it. You see, only the privileged have the luxury of not knowing the answer to that question. Only the privileged have the luxury of never asking it, of never having had to contemplate it. Others, of course, know what it is like to be hunted and hated and terrorized. The only thing new to people of color about September 11th was that for the first time, that terrorism came from another country and not from on the other side of the railroad tracks. That is to say, it wasn't new for everyone. But the privilege was a trap. The privilege allowed the privilege to not think about the way that others may view their nation. Not that anything would justify the murder of 3,000 innocent people, but the point being that there are explanations, even if not excuses, for things. And if you're privileged, you don't even have to think about that. You can just say to yourself, "Well, nobody's going to mess with us, man. We spend $300 billion a year on defense. So don't you know that if you mess with us, we will kill you? Haven't you heard? We will bomb you back to the Stone Age. And if you're already in the Stone Age, we will bomb you back to whatever in the hell came before the Stone Age." And then 19 guys with, what, $25 worth of box cutters and a bad attitude said, "Cool, y'all spend your $350 billion a year on defense. And me and my boys are spending a couple hundred on plane tickets, and we're bringing those buildings down. How do you like us now?" And white folks all of a sudden said, I don't understand. I better go buy a book on Islam. Right? So white folks ran to the bookstores. I gotta read up on Islam, and then I'll understand, right? Which is just fascinating. Right? Again, it sort of assumes the answers are there, not in anything that your society, that your country might have put out in the world, which, though it wouldn't justify the slaughter of 3,000 people, might at least be part of the explanation. See, people of color know that they've always had this love-hate relationship with this country. Perhaps loving, on the one hand, the various opportunities that may be in greater abundance here than in certain other places, but at the other time, as Baldwin said, never having bought the lies, never having the luxury of having believed the lies that white America tells itself about itself. And so for people of color, thinking that someone might hate enough to kill Americans, particularly those in positions of economic disproportionately or political affluence, might not altogether be shocking. And then, of course, how do privileged people respond? See, again, keeping with this theme of dysfunction. It's not just that white folks being privileged don't have to think about this and then we're not prepared for it and we sort of flip out. It's that we then respond to the incident in the way that privileged people respond, which is first to say, "Well, you know why they did it. They did it because they hate our freedoms." Which only privileged people have the luxury of thinking, because only privileged people think they are free, right? Non-privileged, oppressed, dominated, and subordinated folks don't live in that world where they think they have attained freedom, so they know that can't be it. But dominant group members, we have the luxury of, "Oh, yes, it's because of our freedoms." See? And then privileged people have the luxury of saying, "And the way we're going to respond is just bombing people, because that will teach them. We will teach people who are already prepared to die that we will kill them. And that will teach them a lesson." And we, you see, have the right to dictate who can and can't have weapons of mass destruction. And we have the right to dictate who will and will not dominate oil, and we have the right to define terrorism the way we wish to, and we have the right to engage in preventative war, but other nations, especially of color, certainly don't. So you'll remember a few months, about 5 months after 9/11, and after we had launched this preventative war, supposedly, on Afghanistan and are gearing up to do this with Iraq, India and Pakistan, as often happens, get into a beef again, this long-standing running beef over Kashmir. And India says that they are thinking seriously that they may preemptively attack Pakistan because they're afraid Pakistan is going to attack them. And what did the State Department say? No, you can't do that. Right? Because privileged people have the right to use these terms in the way that we see fit and to make war preventatively, but we can't trust the rest of the world with that. So we put out these concepts and these policies, which are actually destabilizing to the world. They are currently, as I speak, destabilizing the globe, and they are only possible coming from the minds of people in those dominant positions. I write about in the book the way that privilege let down the people, in fact set up the people in Littleton, Colorado at the time of the Columbine school shooting, as well as all these other nice, safe, which we know really means in the American lexicon, white and middle class or above communities where they thought nothing could happen to them. Then a school shooting happens, and what do they say? They all say, well, this wasn't supposed to happen here. This is why we moved away from the city. But when was the last time a kid in the city opened up on 15, 16, 20 people, built bombs and planted them all around the school? Where in the hell does an urban dweller go to build 50 bombs anyway? I mean, can you even imagine? Forget the city. Hell, let's just talk about black folk in Littleton. Could two black kids have even gone into the drugstore or the hardware store, wherever the hell you get bomb stuff? What are they going to do? They're going to walk in. They're going to say, yes, this is for a science project. I need about, I don't know, 20, 30 pounds of TNT. I need 15 or 20 blasting caps and some very short fuses. I'll wait. Yes. This isn't even feasible. But because this is a community of privilege, both in terms of race and class, where they do not have to think about the dysfunctions and pathologies, because no one's ever brought them up before, right? No one is, no, the pathology, that's in Denver, and we got away from Denver, we moved from there. So these kids can go into the hardware store, they can get all this bomb-making equipment, they can build these bombs, they can go into class 2 months before they kill all those people and present a video for a grade in a class, a movie that they made and put on tape in which they act out the mass murder of their classmates and teachers. They showed this film 6 weeks to 8 weeks prior to the actual event. I mean, can you just sort of picture this scene? These two white guys who were supposedly despised by everyone, and everybody thinks they're weird, but apparently not too weird, because when they put in the tape where they act out mass murder, I don't know, I mean, what's the teacher doing? Just, that's a fascinating use of imagery and light and costumes, and boy, you should enter that in Sundance or some such thing. I mean, but can you imagine if two of the five black kids at Columbine High School had walked into class 2 months before this and said, yeah, we got this video we want to show you, and yeah, it's just a movie. And it's called The Day We Kill All of Y'all. And in that movie, they act out the murder of hundreds of white people, because that's who was there. Do we not think that this would have raised alarm bells in somebody's mind, that parents and cops would have been called, that families would have been run out of town on a rail? Of course, we know they would have, but in a society and in a community of privilege, oh, we don't have to think about that. And so we can just say that they're just talking, they're just running their mouth, they don't mean anything by it, they're good kids from good families, and then we know what happens. So in a sense, privilege allows you to let down your guard to the pathologies and the dysfunctions, and although that might all be good 364 days out of the year, if day 365 is Columbine, if day 365 is 9/11, then the other 364 don't taste quite as good as they once did. So those are some of the cost mentally and emotionally. It takes you to a place of unreality, and remaining in that place for too long leads to policies and positions and decisions on the part of policymakers then ratified too often by voters, which are dysfunctional and even harmful, even for those who are white and receive privilege. But there are also political, economic, and social costs that I want to run through very quickly. On the one hand, this is the entire history of the development of the concept of whiteness and the white race. And many of us, of course, have read the various works on this subject, so I won't belabor the point for long. But let it suffice to say that the development of this notion, of this concept of the white race, which was, of course, quite foreign to European peoples upon coming to these shores, but it was a concept they would have to learn and did learn with alacrity once they got here, was a concept that was used specifically for one reason, to convince those who were first indentured servants and then after that nonetheless landless peasants with not a pot to piss in, that their interests were indeed interests of skin and common European heritage, that is to say now what we call race, over economic and cultural interests which previously had animated them mostly. That is to say that if you go back to the 1600s and you look at the colonies of what would become the United States, you know, if you've read the history not, which is taught to us in the schools, but which is available for those of us wishing to dig, that oftentimes, not as often as should have been the case, but oftentimes, those of African descent and those who were first, again, indentured servants of European descent, often joined forces to overthrow aristocratic and repressive governmental systems that they recognized were really operating in neither group's interest. Even though the indentured servants were still slightly better off, of course, than those who were owned for life, there was still a significant amount of oppression, and they understood who the author of that oppression was. But those rebellions, of course, scared the hell out of the elites in those colonies, who then needed to come up with some mechanism by which to divide and conquer those emerging class-based coalitions. So what does one do? One has to expand one's own team, and one does that, in the case of the colonies, by doing what? Creating, really, this concept of the white race and embedding it and enshrining it in law. First, getting rid of indentured servitude, no more of that, and then telling white folks that they are, now that they are white, that they will serve on the slave patrols and help keep black people in line, and they'll be able to testify in court for the first time. They'll be able to own property. Not much. You're still not going to have much, but you'll have rights that you didn't have before. And then, of course, the very first law passed by the Congress of the United States after the Constitution was ratified is the Naturalization Act of 1790, which says what? That all free white persons and only free white persons will be granted automatic citizenship in this country, right? That is to say that the privileging of whiteness then gets enshrined into law. And what do you know? Those who did not have a pot to piss in and who months or years or a few decades earlier knew that their interests were similar to those of African slaves and those on the bottom of the racial, quote unquote, and economic pile have now forgotten that, and they have begun to throw in their lot, if you will, with the elite. And this extends to the Civil War, where you have the elite in the South who are telling you openly in this country why they are seceding and why they seek war. They are blatant about it. We lie about it. Those of us in the South now, we lie. And we say it had nothing to do with slavery, but folk were clear then. See, they didn't have all this guilt about it. They didn't feel guilty about their racism, so they just said it. They said the reason they were leaving the Union was to maintain white supremacy and the ownership of chattel. That was why they didn't come up with all these lofty. There was nothing in the secession convention speeches of those on the floors of those southern states about tariffs and trade. None of that. Read them. It is all about slavery. So you got these rich folks saying it's about slavery. And then you got poor white folks who don't own anything, let alone slaves, going, yeah, I'll go fight for that. Now, that is one hell of a trick. How am I going to get you to go fight to protect my property? Especially when, by virtue of you being a paid laborer, having to charge, let's say, $1 a day to work on somebody's farm, if I'm white and I've got to charge you $1 a day to work on your farm and you can get the black guy to do it for free because you own him, who's going to get the gig? Not me. So in a real sense, the system of chattel slavery underbid and undercut the wage base of the white working class, and yet they fell for it and they did it anyway. Why? Because they were sold this lie of whiteness, and then that lie was combined with the very real, not lie at all, the very real meaning of whiteness in terms of privilege and advantage. And so we traded one set of advantages, those that were relative, for another set, those that were absolute. And it continued into the union movement when you had white union leaders in the AFL mostly, who various unions of the AFL, who said, we want to maintain the professionalism of our union. And that means we don't want these black folks and these Chinese and these Mexican laborers, because they'll undermine the professionalism of our workforce. No, fool, they'll double the size of your union. And the next time you go on strike, that might be helpful. The next time you're seeking to negotiate a raise or better working conditions, you might want to have more people. No, we want to maintain the professionalism. Okay, fine, you'll be broke. Right? Which is to say that in a real sense, white privilege, which was maintained in that kind of a structure for many years at the cost of a much stronger and more unified labor movement, frankly, that white privilege was against and worked against the actual self-interest of an awful lot of these white working class persons. So once again, there are political and economic and social costs that are being paid. The election of 2004 is an interesting example of this, and the analysis of this has been almost completely bungled, right? So that you have Thomas Frank writing this book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And all these nice white liberals love this book. And Thomas Frank basically says, well, you know what's wrong? Because he's trying to find out why it is that working class people basically don't vote their interests. That's his whole shtick, right? So he's like, working class people are voting for Republican candidates who are only going to cut taxes on the rich. Why would they do that? And he uses Kansas as sort of the frame for that. That's great. But there's a problem with his question, first of all. And with his answer, is, well, the Democrats should just return to a politics of class. I don't know how you return to something you never really cared a whole hell of a lot about, but whatever. The Democrats should return to a politics of class. And yet what he's overlooking is that it's not really all of the working class, is it, that doesn't recognize its interest and votes the wrong way, quote unquote, whatever that's supposed to mean. After all, black working class folks aren't voting against their economic interests. Latino working class folks are not voting against their economic interest. Asian Pacific Islanders who are working class are not voting against theirs. The question really isn't what's the matter with Kansas. The question is what's the matter with white folks? We don't want to ask that question because it sounds rude, but that's the deal. It is only white working class people who seem to be abandoning their minds when it comes to looking at their economic interests. All these other folks seem to get it. Similarly, we had folks saying, well, you know, Bush won because of the evangelical vote. But that's simplistic too, because what evangelicals? Not black evangelicals, not Latino evangelicals. They've been polled and they voted at least 4-1 against Bush. So once again, the issue is not what's wrong with Kansas or what's wrong with the working class or what's wrong with evangelical Christians. It's just what's the matter with white folks or red state, blue state. We have a geographic divide in this country. Let's get to the bottom of that, shall we? Yes, by all means, let's. Let's start by asking why it is that white folks in the blue states, including California, the state of New York, Illinois, and Maryland, all of which are thought of as very blue, in each of those states, white folks either voted for Bush or split 50-50 between Bush and Kerry, whereas in the red states, which are thought of as these overwhelmingly red places, black and brown folk overwhelmingly voted against the president. So again, it's not what's wrong with the red states versus the blue states, it's what's the matter with white folks. And even though it's a difficult question to ask, it's one we need to answer. Let me suggest to you a possible answer, and that is that privilege is the thing that has allowed white folks, even if they are getting their clock cleaned at the workplace, even if they don't have a pot to piss in proverbial terms, even if they are getting beaten up by the class system every day, if you're a member of the dominant racial group, you've got just enough experience with advantage and access that you have the luxury of believing if you just work a little bit harder, see, everything's going to get good. So for you to adopt the politics of class doesn't make a lot of sense. For you to beat up on the boss, you think you're going to be the boss. See? Or at least that's what you aspire to. And so if you're a member of that white working class, it's harder to adopt the politics of class because you've got this other identity where you're the winner. Right? And we live in a society that doesn't value the losers, quote unquote. We venerate winners, whether it's ball teams or Donald Trump on that show he's on or Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. We venerate winners. So if I tell you as a working class person to organize on the basis of class, I'm asking you to organize on the basis of the thing that disempowers you. I'm asking you to organize around an identity that brands you as a loser. Now, if you're black or brown and you know you're getting your ass kicked five ways to Sunday, you're going to organize on the basis of whatever's going to keep you alive. And so it's not a big deal for you. But if you've also got the ability to say, no, I don't want to be a worker. I want to be a white man. I don't want to be a worker. I want to be a big man in my Christian evangelical church. I don't want to be a worker. I want to be a heterosexual. So now I want to emphasize all these things that make me big and powerful. I don't want to emphasize the thing that makes me weak. You see? And this explains in large part the divide because look, you can be black, and you can be a man, and you can be an evangelical Christian, and you can be homophobic as the day is long. But at the end of the day, even if you are one of these right-wing evangelical type folks, if you're a person of color, you know full well that the biggest threats to your well-being are systemic and institutional, because that's what puts bread on your table. And so even those folks who share some of those views at the end of the day will still, and the data is very clear on this from the election, will still vote in line with their class interests. But if you have the luxury of going to that privileged place as a white person, as a heterosexual, as an evangelical Christian, especially all three, you're going to do that, you see, because the biggest threats to your well-being are not systemic. Your ability to put food on the table is far less threatened than the person of color who's facing not only a class system, but a white supremacist system. So the biggest threats to your well-being are decidedly gonadal in terms, right? In other words, your threats are gay marriage, and your threats are teaching about gay folks in the schools. And so now your threats are white women working, your wife having a job outside the home, right? These become the biggest things to you. So to be privileged is, in a sense, to allow you to have these other identities which take you away from your actual economic and class interest, actually might make you worse off, make you vote for people who actually are not going to look after you and not going to take care of you in the sense that it matters for your family, but are going to make you feel powerful and superior. So in a real sense, we have to be clear that white privilege is creating in white folks not what Marx would have called false consciousness. That's a real mistake, I think, for us to use that language. But instead, an alternative consciousness, something other than class around which to rally. And it's very dangerous. And unless we are able as people to deconstruct the harms and the damages of that alternative consciousness, that alternative identity, the one that says, I don't have to identify as a worker. I can get mine as a white person, as a white man, as an evangelical, heterosexual, Christian, whatever, or a combination of those. Unless we explain and make very clear and articulate a politics that demonstrates how that is pathological, not only in terms of what it does economically, but the mental and psychological traps I mentioned before, I think we're going to have a very hard time getting white working class folks to come over to a more progressive politic until we are actually making the system of privilege a problem. Not just one that we identify and say, here are your 30 privileges, have you ever thought about these? But actually problematizing them, explaining how those privileges are actually harmful and detrimental and even destructive. That is something that we have to set our minds to in the coming years. Let me finish with one more thing before I take questions, and that is this last thing. Other than the mental and emotional, the political cost, there's also a cost in personal integrity. And I mean that on two different levels, one of which I talk about in the book. Actually, I think I mentioned them both in the book briefly, so I won't go into great detail. But the first is that to be white in a society such as this, where one is constantly bombarded by and conditioned by racist rhetoric and stereotypical imagery and media and such, and bombarded by imagery within the churches of this country that suggests that not only Jesus, but God himself, which is another problematic image, of course, but is not only a him and not only lives in the sky somewhere, but is actually a white man who looks nothing if not like Santa. When you have these images that have normalized whiteness and problematized anything other than whiteness, it ought not surprise us then that we pay for that in terms of our own ability to avoid falling into racist patterns of thought. It chains us to racist thinking, irrespective of our liberalism, irrespective of our progressivism, irrespective of our good intentions. I write about it in the book, going on an airplane just a few years ago to a conference in Iowa, coming from Nashville, going to St. Louis, and walking down the jet bridge of that plane. And I have flown probably 1,000 times by then, and for the first time in all of those years of air travel, looking into the cockpit as I got on the plane and seeing not one but two black pilots at the helm of the plane about to fly me to St. Louis. It was the first time that had ever happened, because less than 3% of the pilots in the U.S. are black, so to have even one African-American pilot is really rare. To have two is just extraordinary, almost unheard of. But there they were, and there I was, this person who makes my living and lives and breathes and eats and sleeps anti-racism. This is what I do, not only for a living, but as a life commitment. I understand intellectually, philosophically, theologically, spiritually, all these different levels why and how racism is wrong. And yet, what do you think the first thought that came into my mind, purely emotional, purely instantaneous, purely not a cognitively thought out thought, but nonetheless a real one, do you think? And I'll make it multiple choice because, you know, we're used to that. It just makes it easier. Do you think it was A, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. Or do you think it was B, oh dear God, can these men fly this plane? And of course, the answer was B. And the good news is that I was able to catch that thought immediately as it entered my mind. I was able to grasp it. I was able to wrestle with it. And I was able to defeat the thought. But the bad news is that ain't the point. It does not matter that I was able to defeat or cancel the thought. And it doesn't matter that maybe 2 days later, in a better mood, with more rest, I might not have had that reaction at all. It doesn't matter that on that day you might not have had it. The point is, I had it that day. I had it that time. And if I'm capable of going to that place in spite of everything I know to be true intellectually, and yet knowing that we don't always operate on the basis of what we know intellectually, we operate on the basis of a bunch of bullshit. that gets planted in us over which we have very little control, knowing that to be true, that scares the hell out of me. And it should scare the hell out of you because it means that no one is immune from that thinking. Now, the good news is I can pat myself on the back, you know, and say, oh, I'm doing my work and I was able to catch it. But the point is, how are we led away from what we know so easily? What does it mean that in the few months prior to that plane, there had been half a dozen white guys pulled out of the cockpits of their planes because they were too damn drunk to fly them? And yet, every time I see a white pilot, I don't go, oh God, I wish they'd give him a blood alcohol test. I bet he's drunk, right? What does it say that in spite, I should have been happy to have anybody but a white guy, right? Because like 2 weeks before this, there were two white pilots for Southwest, and they're sort of funny anyway. Two white pilots for Southwest who thought, well, we're not going to drink, but what the hell, let's just take off our clothes in the cockpit and invite the flight attendants in as a practical joke. So I should have been happy to see black guys because I know full well that these black men were not going to sit there and think, oh, let's just get naked and invite some white women in and see how that goes. They would know that they would never keep their job. But these white guys were like, well, they're not going to fire us. No, we're just going to take off our clothes. You know? Privilege, crazy stuff, you know? And yet I don't see white guys and go, now, you better have your clothes on and I better not see any drinks in the cockpit. But I see these black men who I've never even had an experience with as pilots. And I go to that place. And that's one level at which we lose a sense of who we are or who we want to be. And the other is this thing I mentioned in the book very briefly. You know, when I do these workshops, sometimes I ask white people and I ask black folks and I ask Latinos. I ask everybody, what do you like about being whatever you are? So like if you're white, I say, you know, tell me what you like about being white. If you're black, what do you like about being black, et cetera, right? It's really a fascinating experiment. You ought to do it sometime. You ask people this question, and white folks, of course, you know, we haven't thought about that before, usually, so for a couple of seconds, we're just like, oh, God, I don't know. Let me think about it, you know. And because, you know, being white, we have to have an answer. So we're going to think about it. We're going to come up with something. We can't just say, I don't know. And then you ask black folk, and it's interesting. Black folk have this amazing litany of answers. Every time. Never takes a second. And this sort of stuns white people. Because white folks, I think, are conditioned in this country to believe that black folks couldn't possibly like anything about being black, right? We just sort of assume, we've internalized this assumption of negativity, and we've assumed that black people feel the same way about black people that we feel about black people. And although there is such a process as internalized racial oppression, I'll tell you what, you do this exercise and that all goes out the window because black folks have a litany of positive things. And it's always fascinating what they are, right? It's things like internal fortitude, the ability to overcome obstacles, persistence, not giving up, all this stuff about family and culture and really deep abide. And there's a smile on the face of people as they say it in the midst of oppression, having this great pride and all these accomplishments in spite of all of these barriers. And then you get to the white folks. Now the white folks come up with their list after a few minutes and our list, and it's predictable. Right? It's, well, I like the fact that I don't get followed around the store. I like the fact that I don't have to worry that my race is going to make me suspicious when I try to write a check. I like the fact that the cops don't think I'm in the wrong neighborhood when I'm just coming home from work. It's all this stuff about privilege. And what's fascinating is when you look on the wall, because you do this on newsprint, you put it up, right? And the white folks are looking at the black list. The black folks are looking at the white list. Latinos are looking at both, whatever. And Latinos and Asians and indigenous people also have very similar answers to the ones that black folks have. Right, they're all about internal stuff, about overcoming, about maintaining. And the white folks have all this list of privilege. And what does this suggest? Well, it's interesting because if you look at the white list and you ask, what do all those things have in common other than being privileges? What else do they have in common? Not one of them is about what white people actually like about being white. It's what white people like about not being black or brown. Which is to say that to be white is, in a sense, to define yourself by a negative. It is to define yourself by what you were not, not what you are. And that is a deep level of damage, so deep that I doubt seriously we're even capable of understanding how deep-rooted that is and then excavating it fully. And don't get me wrong, the black folk in the room, oh, they'd love to be able to say some of the stuff the white folk said about not getting followed, being able to get mortgages more. I mean, black and brown folk would love to have some stuff on the white list, but don't forget that the white folks would also dearly love to have some of that stuff on the black and brown list about integrity and about overcoming. And what's interesting, when I first did this experiment, which actually the first time I experienced it was in a workshop done by the People's Institute. It wasn't my idea. What was interesting was the first time I sat through that, I remember asking, was it always like this? Because surely those of us now called white once had those things. We once had culture, and we once had heritage, and we once had a resistance culture. That, because let's be honest, the Europeans that came here were not the cream of the crop. The cream of the crop didn't leave. They had no reason to leave. The Europeans that came were not the winners, right? So many of us came from these oppressed and marginalized European groups. So we had a culture of resistance. So there was a time when you could have asked those of us now called white, what do you like about being Irish? What do you like about being Italian? What do you like about being a Russian Jew? And we would have said all that same stuff. And that has been wrung out of us like water out of a towel. So now we have none of it. Because we had to give all, that's what Baldwin called the price of the ticket. The price of the ticket for becoming white was having to give up all of that and subordinate that and sublimate that to your whiteness, which now meant that all of these disparate groups no longer were about resistance. They were about the man. They were the man. They got to become the man. Right? And there comes a point where generations later you look at that list and you then realize, only then, some of the beauty and some of the wonder that you actually had to give up, the things that kept your people alive. What kept your people alive were not merely the privileges, it was the stories, it was the heritage, it was the language, it was the history, and that was given up. 9 times out of 10. Don't teach your children Yiddish. Don't teach your children Italian. Don't teach your children Irish. This isn't true for all such white ethnics, quote unquote, but it's true for an awful lot. Right? So much so that I think if we really had to explain what the cost of privilege is, it is the loss of one's cultural soul and cultural integrity and history, so much so that one then has no sense of who one is. Baldwin was also famous for saying that the only people in this country who knew who they were black people. Because nobody was going to let black folks forget, and black folks had to forge something out of nothing. But those of us who now are called white, we have no idea who or what we are. And as long as we continue to live within that lie of whiteness and to bask in the advantages, all of which are very real, without ever interrogating what we've lost in order to obtain them, we're going to continue to follow down policy and practice and procedure roads which are destructive to others and ultimately destructive of ourselves. And so I think that there are reasons, not only moral and ethical, but very self-interested about our own survival and our own integrity as human beings on this planet that ought to lead us to realize this is not a black issue. It is not a brown issue. It is not a red issue. It is not a yellow issue. It is first and foremost a white issue. And until we are as angry about it and take it as seriously as those who were the targets and the victims of it, there won't be any peace and there won't be any justice in this land that I would like very much to love. Thank you very much and take care and God bless.
Tim Wise, anti-racist educator, speaking recently in New Jersey. Thanks to Fred Wien for that recording. And for Finger Lakes listeners, there will be a workshop on militarism in the schools, recruitment awareness, selective service registration, and the No Child Left Behind Act. That will take place next Saturday, April 1st, at the Rural Urban Center Auditorium, 208 Broadway Street in Montour Falls, from 12:30 to 3:30 p.m. next Saturday. It's free of charge and sponsored by Conscious Alternatives to Militarism. For more information and to register, call 546-7354 in the 607 area code. You can download MP3s and podcasts of this program at our site on welcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by